Good morning. I'm Renee Bodley Miller, General Manager of KPCW. Today I'm filling in for Nell Larson and Chris Cherniak. Because they're both out today, they wanted me to share with you two of their favorite interviews from the show. So we hope you enjoy this best of version of This Green Earth. The first interview is with Stephen Nash. He's the author of Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Nash is the author of two books on science and the environment. His reporting has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Bioscience, Archaeology, and the New Republic. Nash shared how industrial exploitation and climate change is threatening hundreds of thousands of square miles of publicly owned national landscape. Here's that conversation.
So, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So today's the 100th anniversary of the establishment of Grand Canyon National Park. Did you schedule your book release to coincide with that?
No, actually, I didn't. I started researching this book on a hike with my great-nephew a few years ago. And so it just it came out when it came out. But happy birthday, Grand Canyon National Park.
You, like most authors, you were probably shooting for 98 or 99, and it ended up being 100.
It does take a while.
Serendipity, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about your motivation to write this book.
Well, it was the hike that I mentioned. And when we were down there in the bottom of the canyon, we got into a conversation with a person who was doing science research at Grand Canyon. And that person said something that surprised both of us. She said, "I don't know if you're aware of it, but Grand Canyon National Park, in terms of its biology, is falling apart." Hmm. And she said, "That's true of the whole national park system." Well, that sounded pretty outlandish, although she was calm when she said it. But it started me asking questions, and one question led to another. And in fact, she was right.
So you started perhaps by looking at these biological communities then, and it seems like those questions kind of opened up this whole world of issues that the parks are facing. So in the book, you're looking at a whole plethora of issues, right?
Yes. These are complicated natural systems, and we've set up some very complicated challenges for them. The overarching challenges, however, are climate change on the one hand, which is pushing the plants and animals at Grand Canyon, at all of the national parks and in all of our natural lands, pushing them north a little at a time, but it's going to accelerate because they have to stay within the kind of a climate envelope that they've evolved to survive within. They have to find cooler places or die out. And if we're lucky, they'll have cooler places to go to and they'll be able to get there. That's not just true for bighorn sheep and antelope and animals. It's also true for trees and the rest of the plant life in all these natural places.
But in addition to that, Steve, sometimes if just going north may not solve your problem if you're a sheep or a coyote, because elevation change, physical change, chemical change, the habitat, the scenery changes, and so your food source might be there, although it might be cooler. So a lot of moving parts.
Well, there are a lot of moving parts, and you're right to think that the soils matter. The elevation matters. A lot of things matter. Those are part of a conversation that we really need to have. Where is the sort of patchwork of factors that will enable this or that species or ecosystem to survive? But it's important, while it's important to get into the weeds, the more important thing that's staring us in the face is that you can't move bighorn sheep or anything else into a landscape that's covered with oil rigs and pump jacks or mining excavation. Hmm. You can't move them through a forest that's been clear cut and the soils are washing away. In order for those smaller considerations, very important ones, to be on the table, we have to take care of the big things. And, you know, Utah is sort of an epicenter of this national conversation. Whenever I was inquiring about the politics of how we should adapt to climate change, I kept running into Utah. Very, very important.
One of the other topics that you talk about in the book is one that I think we often don't think about when we're in the parks, and that's the species that are gone, that are no longer there, species that have become extinct completely or just locally extirpated. Talk about that and what you found out about that impact in the Grand Canyon.
Well, it's a reminder, really, that this conversation about private interests who look at our public lands as a kind of a private piggy bank and who have a lot of political clout and tens of millions of dollars to spend to try to have things their way. That battle has been going on for at least 100 years and actually a lot more than 100 years, and it's continuing now. So all of these public lands are a kind of a bequest from our great-grandparents who had these battles and assembled this marvelous portfolio, a million square miles of public land that still is in public hands. But at any rate, that same tension really continues. So as climate change begins to exert pressures, if we have public lands intact, we've got this marvelous, hopeful opportunity. But if we keep busting them up for industrial uses, then those opportunities will be foreclosed. And, you know, it just occurs to me at the end of this long oration that I didn't answer your question. Could you ask me again?
It was interesting nonetheless. But I was curious about kind of like that legacy of the species that are no longer in some of these parks and like, ghosts, as you refer to
like
them.
Like wolves or something like along those lines?
Yeah. Thank you for your patience. As a matter of fact, that's another Utah connection. William Newmark has been writing science, not political commentary about these issues, since the middle 1980s when he did a really landmark study of major national parks. He's at the Utah Museum of Natural History, I think it is now, but he was at the University of Utah then, if I'm not mistaken. And what he did was ask how many of the species that belong in these big national parks in the U.S. and Canada are still there, and he found even back then that 20% of the species of Grand Canyon National Park aren't there anymore. The parks are, even though they seem vast to us, they're not quite large enough to maintain a full suite of species, even with the landscape being relatively highly protected. So wolves aren't there anymore. We could reintroduce them, but for political reasons, we haven't.
Right.
Jaguar, I was surprised to learn, used to be part of Grand Canyon National Park. There were grizzly bears on that landscape in the higher elevations.
Right.
Those are all gone, along with some smaller species. There was a very cool-looking little animal, the southwestern river otter, which is now apparently extinct. But those are just some examples of what used to be there and isn't there anymore.
Right, and that's just land-based animals. Does include perhaps insects, plants, birds, etc. And you say, Steve, what's interesting, you say 20%, or at least the studies suggested 20% loss of species. That's of the species that we know, right? Typically, we always talk about there are millions of species we haven't even identified yet that may also be gone.
Yes, so, especially the smaller ones that, nonetheless, as E.O. Wilson once said, it's the little things that run the world.
Yeah.
So insects and microorganisms have a huge role to play in things, and we're not even aware of some of those, of some of their existence. So we can lose them before we even get to study them, and there are thousands of species of those kinds in Grand Canyon also. And as the climate changes, or as some of these other conditions begin to impinge on our national parks, those things change too.
So, well, let's go back 100 years to 1919 when the park was established. I believe that was the Wilson administration did
it
that.
Was.
Do you have it? Can give us a sense of why they did that? What did they see?
You know, if you're like me, you kind of grew up with national parks and maybe you took family excursions to them, and they were a legacy that we all took for granted. But in fact, 100 years ago, when Grand Canyon National Park was declared, and indeed when the whole National Park Service was declared, which was only 3 years earlier than that, It was at the end of decades of real political challenges and really real fights. It was one contingent, the sort of Teddy Roosevelt wing of the national discussion, I guess you could call it, although he had plenty of support in Congress and plenty of support in Utah. Teddy Roosevelt said, these are public lands. We have to keep them in public lands and protect them, even way back then. And Roosevelt was, you know, a big outdoorsman and a big macho hunter. But right. He had this protection mantra, and he was very good at advancing it for the rest of us, that we need wilderness of this kind. But that conversation had started in the 1880s, and it wasn't. And of course, there were people. You can still see the old mines that are still in Grand Canyon. You can still see evidence of lots of other human development. People wanted to run railroads and build hotels down in the canyon. There was lots of great big plans for private development. Roosevelt said, you know, if you want this place to stay what it is, the best thing to do is leave it alone. You can't do better than that. So 3 years later, after the passage of World War I and some other distractions, 3 years after the Park Service was created, we were able to get Grand Canyon National Park. But that fight is still with us, and in fact, it's really stepped up now.
It certainly has, and is something we've been hearing quite a bit about here in Utah. Not only kind of the creation and maintenance of these places, but also their funding we've been hearing more about recently. And that's again, something that you cover as one of the serious challenges. So what are you hearing from the folks in the Park Service and the scientists that you talk to about the impacts of funding or lack thereof on the well-being of the parks?
You know, I hiked out of the bottom of the canyon toward the end of my research with the gentleman who was then the superintendent and also his chief science administrative officer. And she told me at Grand Canyon National Park, funding had been cut so much over so long a period, and this was before the current administration, that they didn't even have a geologist on the Grand Canyon Park science staff. Maybe that situation has been repaired, but I doubt it because funds have been cut even more since then. The science that all of our national the point at which they are becoming increasingly popular. 6 million people visited Grand Canyon last year.
Wow.
And just at the point where we need more and more good, solid research so we can make good decisions about protecting those public lands.
Is private funding a possibility? Could somebody sponsor a geologist for the Grand Canyon, in a sense?
I'm glad to hear just the beginnings of indignation in your question.
Thank you.
Yes, they could. And in fact, what that science administrator told me was that she was spending more and more of her time looking for grants from private foundations to help the national parks. That's always, that kind of philanthropy is always a worthwhile place to go, but it's not enough, and it means that while you're spinning your wheels trying to chase around and find private funds and competing with everybody else who needs that charity, while you're doing that, the science isn't getting done. You know, the parks were created by the government. They didn't just happen, and they were created by a government because we pushed the government to do that. That's the situation now, too. If we want the parks to be protected and the future of those natural systems to be protected and the benefits that they bring us, we're just going to have to push really, really hard for that to happen.
Was there anything that you kind of learned during your researching of this book that really surprised you?
There were smaller scale things. For instance, that, as I mentioned a moment ago, there used to be jaguar in Grand Canyon. The last one was shot in the 1930s, which is comparatively recently. On the larger scale, I guess, on the largest possible scale, I was able to talk a couple of climate physicists at Texas Tech, Sharmista Swain and Catherine Hayhoe, into doing projections of what the climate of some of our national parks is going to be like and how it's going to be changing in the coming decades, on the assumption, which is not an optimistic one, that we will continue on the same path we're on now in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. That's the business as usual scenario. And what they projected that surprised me was that the climate of Grand Canyon National Park, just taken as a whole, is going to be moving a couple of hundred miles south by the middle decades of this century. And in effect, Grand Canyon will have the same kind of climate that the places on the Mexican border, several hundred miles away, have had in the past. By then, Mexico will be a lot hotter, too. But in Utah, the climate is moving south, in effect. The landscape's still going to be there, but it's as if southern latitudes are moving north. And as that happens, of course, all the living systems have to move north to stay ahead of it if they can.
There's a really cool map that you have put together in the book that kind of shows geographically like where these parks would be. And one that really, with a change in climate, and one that really spoke to me or surprised me was Yellowstone National Park, right? It's in northern Wyoming. And by the end of the century, this century, the climate will be such as if it was in southern Utah. And so it's just kind of mind-blowing to think about what that means for the ecosystem change and the wildlife change and how quickly that's going to happen.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
You're right. That's the northwestern corner of Wyoming, way, way far to the north. And just in the next few decades, by the middle decades of this century, again, a business-as-usual scenario, Yellowstone is going to be in northern Utah. That is, that's an enormous shift. And then you're right. Southern Utah by the end of the century, and it continues on from there. So what are we doing to consolidate public lands and raise the level of protection so that the priority is natural systems rather than industrialization? The answer is that there are very well-funded and very politically powerful interests, many of them centered in Utah, who are pushing in the other direction to break up public lands and to sell them off to private interests, or at least sell their natural resources off in ways that foreclose the survival of the natural systems. Just in the last 2 years, oil and gas leases on public lands have tripled, and a lot of that's happening in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
By executive order in December, the current administration has decreed that logging on public lands will jump by 30%. What's happened to national monuments in Utah, I know it's a familiar story for you, Bears Ears and Escalante Grand Staircase,
mm-hmm.
They have been cut back so thoroughly. It's been called the biggest rollback of protections for public lands in American history. Millions of acres that were briefly protected under national monument status in the way that's needed to cope with climate change, all of that got snatched away, and we're looking instead at coal mining, uranium mining, and gas and oil drilling.
Well, it's time for us to start wrapping up here, but I did want to ask, you know, just as kind of a last question here, what do you see is happening next? What do we need to do to prioritize the health of these parks?
Well, it's easy to come off like a sort of a shrill street corner evangelist about all these things and to sound way too pessimistic. It should not at all be forgotten, because it's the major part of the picture. What an enormous and wonderful opportunity this million square miles of American landscape that's in public hands represents for us. And what should happen next about connecting those lands and protecting them, I think is going to be more and more a part of the conversation as climate change becomes less and less deniable. Just in the last 2 years, we're seeing polling now that's saying that 70% of American voters are now seriously concerned about the impacts of climate change. That situation is starting to pivot, and it won't be long before people who attempt to deny climate change are going to be laughed off the public stage. So we've got this big opportunity with our gorgeous portfolio of natural systems on public lands. And what should happen next is that we begin to fight like our great grandparents did to make these changes happen.
Well, that's inspiring to hear. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.